Good morning. Everybody had a good time. I don't see any really bad red eyes or anything like that, so people did pretty well. As Dennis said, I know there was a lot of discussion yesterday regarding ASO business. Today, I really want to focus on mid-market ASO, talking about segments. A little bit about me, little biography. Really focus on the years I was at Dakota Care. I was there for 17 years. Prior to that, in 1993, kind of helped Dakota Care get into the self-funding business by bringing some larger employers that had a need for self-funding. I was a broker at the time. So we kind of got things kicked off in 1992, 1993, and then by 96, I formally went to work for them in that role for 17 years. We were an upside-down model. We had limited population in that area, but we weren't really limited by territory in the ASO space, and we realized that. So at our peak, we had about 39,000 commercial lives, and we had over 130,000 ASO lives. So we were really an upside-down model. But we had business all through the Midwest, and we only had one really mega group, which was the State of South Dakota Employee Health Plan, which was, at the time was probably 25,000. So really it was 60-some ASO mid-market accounts that added up to over 100,000. So I'd like to focus on how to achieve success in the mid-market, ASO. Sales and marketing experience in the ASO is very, very important. It was discussed yesterday. I think it's being willing to just to come in and have a niche, so we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about administrative flexibility and reporting. Broker engagement. So to me, these are kind of the keys to how to create success in the ASO mid-market. Network competitiveness and stop-loss expertise. So first, starting out in sales and marketing, challenges. Defining an ASO market and strategic positioning within your regional health plan. To me, that's crucial. A lot of you that are currently in the ASO space, I would be willing to bet that you haven't separately branded your ASO product. I think it needs to be branded separately. There needs to be a distinction between your commercial business and your ASO business, although when you tell the story about how we medically manage members and we do all the things that are important to control costs, because that's what you do in your own space, I believe that the branding needs to be and a really good strategic positioning needs to be for that product. And obviously this was talked about yesterday, and I don't want to reiterate it too much, but if you do get into the ASO space, it has to be a priority within the organization. We're in a situation right now where I see around the country regional health plans where the parent hospital systems' margins aren't what they were. Now, that's not true everywhere, but as a general comment, margins are shrinking on the hospital side. They're telling their health plans, you have to make money. You have to stand on your own, and we want you to grow. Well, that's kind of a double-edged sword, as we know, in the commercial space, because if you really want to grow, you need to lower your rates. But that can subject you to having significant unprofitability as well. And, of course, the ACA had a negative leverage for the most part on that with the exchanges for those that participated. So what strategy can you have to grow your membership and bring profits? Nothing better than mid-market ASO, because you can bring on a lot of business, a lot of administrative fees, no risk-bearing, unless you wanted to share risk. You certainly have that option, because obviously we've got reinsurers in the room that would love to share risk. In-house staff committed to ASO. It's really, really important, not just from sales, but administration, claims, operations. You don't need a team of 20 people, but you've got to start out with a team of two or three that are really dedicated to that space and have experience. And I know yesterday was touched upon that, find someone that was in the TPA space, bring them in. They can certainly help out. Sales training. Not just sales training for in-house. One of the things that I focused on a lot was broker training. And my philosophy was really to go in communities within our footprint and find the brokers within those communities that may not know a lot about self-funding, may not even have a self-funded case, but they had strong community ties and they were considered to be a leader in the community. And we would embrace those brokers, bring those in, do trainings with them, and build a value proposition for them. And the value proposition was, look, you know the owners, you know the people, you know these companies, you know these school districts, you know, whatever they are, help get us in. We'll sell the case on your behalf. That's a value proposition. They only needed to know enough to get in the door and tell a simple story. And the story was, really, you need to hear these folks at DAS tell their story. Administrative flexibility and reporting. Obviously, the claim system has to be flexible. Keith talked about this. Brad touched upon it. And I think, she mentioned it as well yesterday, too. But you got to be able to handle custom plan offerings. We talked about that. It can't be cookie cutter. You know, you've got to be able to literally, and Rhonda Mack knows this very, very well, you see some crazy plan designs over the years, and you got to be able to accommodate that. Advanced funding. I don't really think that was really touched upon it yesterday, but you know, you've got to be able to pen the claim, hold it in the system, file the reinsurance, get the reinsurance recovery back so it's a simultaneous transfer to that employer. You don't want to be that plan, that TPA, that administrator that puts cash flow problems onto the employer. It scares them. You want to, when you're telling the story about mid-market ASO, you're telling them that their risk is boxed and that they won't have any cash flow issues between what they've got in stop loss, potentially aggregate, that to them it almost looks like a fully insured premium. You know, solid reporting, things like that. We'll talk about that in a minute. Whoops. How do I do?
You hit the middle button.
Oh, I did. All right. I got big thumbs. Secure portal for benefit enrollments, billing, and claims. I'm assuming that a lot of you have done that for your own commercial business. You've created these things. Same thing needs to be done in the ASO space. You've got to be able to have both members, employers, whether it's your own physicians, be able to see data within certain portals for benefit enrollment, billing, and claims runs. Dedicated customer service to ASO. I think that's really, really important. It's a specialized training for those folks because they're literally looking up online, on screen, an SPD. And they're looking at those benefits and they're being able to talk intelligently to that member that's calling in. Dedicated customer service and dedicated claims people. Those are the main things. I think, Keith, you'd agree to that, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
And then we talked about reporting a little bit yesterday. Through the years, I kind of felt that there were certain reports that I wanted to have that allowed our ASO groups to go online and have these reports that would change every month. But just as importantly, I wanted to create a reporting package that would help me and my dedicated account managers to set up that group always for the next renewal, to really transparently show them where they were at during the year, but really, really use that as a retention tool as well. So I'll show you some of the reports I like to use. This first one is an RX PMPM. I'm a big fan of not PEPM reports, but per member per month. Because as you guys all know, that's our true costs. So this one just shows an RX PMPM, and it's a historical. It shows 2012, 2016. And then behind that, talk about the top 20 medications by plan cost, the top 20 medications by script count, the top 20 drug types. This particular report is probably my favorite. I like to use this because sometimes, you know, as you know, you walk into an employer, they've had a couple catastrophic claims during the year, and their mindset is, oh my God, I'm having a horrible year. Well, when you show them a report like this, to step back and show them what their actual cost per member per month is, less reinsurance filed, because they obviously got that money back, right, on those claims. You can show them trends to say, you know what, you're actually having a pretty good year. Look at your trend slope. Your trend slope is actually moving down from 2000, so you're detrending on a per member per month basis on your claims. So you're doing well. So you walk out of there and they're feeling good now about their ASO program. Break down the claims by diagnosis category. So you really kind of drill down a little bit about where are my larger claims coming from, where's my cost at, what do I need to do, do we need to install a disease management program, do we have to get more aggressive on our population health, what do we need to do? And then this is just the same but dispersed into a pie chart. Yes.
When you talk about specifically the mid-market, 100 to 500, 100 to 1,000, you know, in that range, how often are those reports really utilized by the employer group, and how often is it really more the broker? Is there, can you give us an idea of just how often it actually filters down to you sit in front
sure.
of that group?
We had ideals of grandeur when we put together the portals and gave access to our brokers and self-funded groups that, oh man, we're going to put these reports because they're live and, you know, they're real time. And what we found out, nobody looks at them. Brokers don't look at them. Employers don't look at them. Now, the real large mega groups, they look at them because they've got consultants that, I mean, look at them all the time. But mid-market, no. So we made sure that on a quarterly basis, we went out to see our employers. My account managers, they were ordered to go out and see these employers once a quarter. Pull these reports, the most current report, and give them the information. Always include the broker, obviously, on the case, but engage the broker and our account management team to go out and see our clients. Speaking of broker engagement.
I'm sorry.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Before we leave the last segment, can we go back to where you said the ability to hold the claim and almost pend it and wait for the reinsurance reimbursement? I'd like for some of the reinsurance carriers to speak to that, because at least the few that we've worked with so far in our early days here, they demand that the claim be paid before they'll reimburse. Is that a consistent situation among most reinsurance carriers?
Alex, would you like to speak to that? Did you want to be recorded, Alex?
No, I'm going to give her my business card. No, you know, when it comes to, I think I don't want to answer it one specific way, because I don't think that there's one specific answer. If I were to tell you that as a carrier we do it one way, it would be incorrect. It really depends on the relationship you have. And, you know, we have relationships with carriers, and we've had them in the past, where you have a case, two cases on the books. You don't see a lot of volume. You don't have that relationship. That's just the reality of life. And you're stricter about how you go about doing that. But there are other relationships where it's totally integrated. Some of them even risk sharing. And they're in those situations that does not have to be paid ahead of time. But it does take a very special relationship. I'm sure Tom will touch on that. We touched on it a little bit yesterday about having partnership relationships with stop loss carriers.
Well, I know we do also in some circumstances we do advance funding. So again, it's I know we do it routinely in level funded products. So, but on the larger group, I think it's again more like Alex said. I think in certain circumstances we offer it.
Okay, thank you. So broker engagement. I talked about earlier. You know, presentations to brokers. It was really really, really important. And it didn't matter. I would go to, from the Midwest, I go to places like Minneapolis, Des Moines, Kansas City, whatever. I wanted to touch the large brokers as well as the community brokers. I wanted to show them that, hey, if they've got a client in our space, we've got a value proposition for them. And so it was really important, I felt, to do that. We also did symposiums. We did at least one symposium a year where we would invite all of our broker distribution and ask them to invite prospects. ASO prospects. And we'd also have our current clients at these. And we always had a topic of the year. You know, back in the day it was HIPAA, or it was, you know, beginning of the ACAs or whatever. We maybe had a really great medical management story that we wanted to tell. So we would have outside speakers come in, usually meet at 10 o'clock in the morning. We go to noon, serve them lunch, get them out of there by 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But we really had great success in doing that, because it was a way that we could show off what we were doing in medical management, what we were doing with our technology and our portals and other things. And I'll tell you what, we ended up writing a lot of business because of those symposiums, because we actually impressed brokers and we were able to impress some ASO employers that we did not have currently. Again, I talked about dedicated account managers as part of that broker engagement. Monthly and quarterly reporting online. And then using that to build that renewal strategy that I talked about. I think that was really, really important. By the time you're there on the third quarterly meeting, they're already talking about the renewal, and they're talking about what their expectations are. And obviously, if you've got the right data and you know exactly what's going on with their large claims and their total utilization as a whole, you can really position yourself very, very well, because you can kind of guess what their renewal is going to be from a stop-loss perspective, and you can kind of get the renewal done early. Stop-loss. My philosophy with stop-loss was really to engage and have partners in stop-loss and not just markets to quote. I felt that was a waste of time. So I would get calls from stop-loss carriers all the time wanting to do business with us. And I would ask a couple questions. Are you looking for quotes? Are you looking for a partner? Looking for a partner, okay. Well, what does that mean? Well, to me, it meant strategic partnerships, and it meant engaging not just the person that was calling me, the salesperson, but their underwriters, their actuaries, all the way sometimes up to the CEO level. I wanted them to know what we were all about. I felt that was important. I thought, how am I going to go out and sell stop loss if they don't know who I am, if they don't know what my company does, if they don't know Rhonda Mack, if they don't know our chief medical officer, if they don't know our underwriting team, if they don't know how we do disease management, how we do population health, how we do all the things that regional health plans are really, really good at doing. So that's how we've developed partnerships. And with that partnership, those partnerships, we were able to develop large blocks of business. And it got down to the point where through engaging the underwriters and really their entire organizations with us, we were able to provide them creditable data. They trusted the data. They knew what we were showing them was real, and that we knew what we were talking about, and it created a block of business renewal strategy. So in other words, it wasn't one account at a time, because in a block of business, you're going to have some groups that are running well, you're going to have some groups that are running really bad. My thing was, let's underwrite the block of business. So you tell me, carrier, what do you need as an overall renewal strategy on this block of business? Well, we think we're going to need 12%. Okay, 12%. We'll deliver 12%. So that bad group, instead of getting 35%, maybe only gets 20. The good group, instead of getting a pass or a 5%, we might give them 10, but we managed it on a block basis. Our retention was higher. We were able to write more business. So with that, questions?
So I really like your last idea as far as like spreading the wealth sort of on rate increases. But how? So did you go to the stop loss carrier and just say, hey, you want X amount more in premium, we think we can deliver that? I mean, how does that kind of arrangement work? Because obviously they're not just going to say like, oh yeah, you know, fine, you distribute this.
I made it sound simple.
Okay.
Let's just say we had a dozen cases with a carrier. We would sit down probably the first part of February, because you'd let, you know, year end go, run through, and we'd sit down and say, all right, let's talk about strategy for this year. These are the 12 groups. Here's the loss ratios on 12 groups. Here's the shock claims on all 12 groups. Now, based on that, because we've obviously got their underwriter in the room, let's build a renewal strategy on this block of business for the year. So that's basically what we did.
Other Thank questions? You. I'd like to put out some questions for the room as a whole to kind of get a feel for one another for where we're at in this market space and some of the things that you're doing. So if you're okay with it, I'll throw out some questions and we'll get a feel for what one another is doing. Let's start with, for how many of you, yesterday, several of you had talked, Geisinger and some others had talked about how your ASO business had crossed over your regular commercial business, and now, to Tom's point, they crossed that line a long time ago where their ASO business was larger than their commercial line of business. If you look just at this market segment, has anyone crossed that line yet on this market segment? So where your mid-size group, and for these purposes, we're describing that as 100 to 500, where it's crossed. Has anyone reached that point yet? So where are you in that? Are you starting to see a pickup in the mid-size group? Are you starting to see much more interest? Are you seeing that trend line go up? In terms, and if you look at it from number of accounts, not number of lives, obviously, but number of accounts, how does the number of accounts in this mid-size group for your ASO business compare to the number of accounts that you have on the straight commercial side? So just give us a feel for where you're at in this market space and how important it, start at Geisinger, thank you.
Hi, I'm Connie with Geisinger. So we are not even anywhere close in this market segment with competing with our fully insured. And the reason for that is, there's many reasons, but the primary reason is we compete against ourselves on fully insured versus self-funded in-house, which just is incomprehensible to me, but it is what it is. But also in our market, the biggest competitor is Highmark, and they are always willing to buy business on a fully insured basis. And my mantra is always, a claim is a claim. I can't do anything to buy the business with that claim or those claims and set the projections differently. But the amount of money thrown at these fully insured groups in that market segment is incomprehensible, and we just can't compete. So I probably, most 75% of my membership is in large hospital systems for the most part. So we have had some success in that market, but it's nowhere near the fully insured. So mm-hmm. we have our struggles.
Mm-hmm. Others, what are some of the challenges that you have in your marketplace? How would you describe, this market space that you're working in? You mentioned strong competitors willing to buy the business on the fully insured side, which makes it difficult. How about the rest of you? In our conversations, we as we were putting this meeting together, we talked a lot about, you saw a lot of opportunity. Do you see the opportunity in your market space? How would you describe that opportunity? And then to Geisinger's point, what are some of the challenges that you have in the space? Kevin?
I don't know if this answers your question, but yesterday it came up about how these groups were being handled. And I'm trying to remember the exact topic, but I guess where I was going with this is that the number of groups that are in that segment that everybody's chasing, the sweet spot, 1 to 500, for you, Connie, what does that represent in the marketplace for you? Is that 75% of your business or 15% of your business?
Of our business overall?
Meaning
The group size in the market is primarily, there's a lot of businesses. We're in a very rural area for the most part, mm-hmm. so there's a lot of very, very small businesses. So I'm just making this up, but I would say probably only 25% of the businesses are in that space.
Okay.
That might be a little bit low, because I don't know for certain, but it's hard to find a 500 life case in our area for the most part.
Right. So I'm asking the question because in terms of the size of the group and the amount of money and time that everybody's putting into ASO, I think the cutting edge becomes administrative cost. Claims is there, but it's administrative cost. That's what I heard yesterday. Would you say the spread between what you can do in a regional plan on ASO is anywhere near what I'll call the vanillaization of a Cigna or an Aetna that comes in with, pretty sharp pricing?
It just depends on the prospect. So we've had some success with looking at the BUCAs who have, let's say there's a 500 life employer group in our market, but then they have 500 employees somewhere else. We've been successful in riding the local location because we can smack the ball out of the park with the discounts, the population health management, and so forth. And then we'll have another stop-loss carrier, which we were totally adverse to when I walked in the organization. But we'll have, like, let's say this one case we have has Aetna for the 500 people outside of Pennsylvania. Then we have Aetna stop-loss riding over top of both of us, which at one point we wouldn't do. So it works out really, really well. And then the way we make our money on that case is not just on the admin fee, but on some spread pricing and keeping rebates and things of that nature. So it's been a very successful case, and the results for that, a couple of those cases are absolutely amazing.
For some of the rest of you that are taking a look at this market space, what are some of the other challenges or the characteristics of the market? I'm particularly also curious about, and we'll talk about marketing in another minute here, but what are some of the unique needs or perspectives that you're seeing in this among this group, either their decision-making process or what they're looking for in terms of products, services, that kind of thing. Jerry?
In Tennessee, we find the benefit manager in this size group, 100-500, pretty unsophisticated. They're not usually dealing with a big consultant, they're dealing with a local broker. And so what we've tried to do is get the CFO in the room. If you get the CFO in the room along with the benefit manager, you can tell a more sophisticated story and differentiate yourself.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. For some of the rest of you that are pursuing this market space, how would you describe your local market and you know, what their interests are? And
I'm Bart with Cox Health Plans. This is our sweet spot as well. Our president doesn't want us to go below 100 when it comes to our ASO products. But like what's been repeated before, like Connie says, we don't have a whole lot of this business. And to just almost reiterate again, the brokers aren't real educated. We have one that's a very educated broker in the area, but it's tough to get us, me and my account reps, in front of the actual decision makers. So that's probably the biggest challenge. Not that we can't do it, but we can't get in front of the decision makers to prove it. And we're working on those relationships, but I think one of the things that our brokers are afraid to do is all of a sudden now we're the experts and they're no longer the expert. Hmm. And so they lose that control. So
a little bit of little threatening.
Absolutely. And so if we sell the self-funded, well, there's always that other broker that's the big one in our area that can, maybe they go talk to him and they could potentially lose the account. So a lot of dynamics, just a lot of dynamics, and everybody really wants those 100-plus groups, so every broker's trying to hit them.
So it's kind of underscoring the relationships and how your team is building those relationships and the time that takes. Ashley?
So historically, this segment in Western Massachusetts has been fully funded, and they really like being fully funded, but they're having to consider other options just because they have nowhere to go because of the price increases.
The cost.
So costs, as costs continue to rise, and they've, you know, gone as far as they're comfortable with deductibles and MOOPs and things like that and copays, they just can't afford to be, you know, they're looking for the next place to go in terms of, I'm going to call it a buy down. Mm-hmm. So that dynamic is, it's not that they really want to do it. They just don't feel like that they have anywhere else to go. So, and then there's this concept that some of the brokers in our areas are, they're trying to sell them on these captive arrangements where they go into almost like what we were talking about in terms of the block of, you know, doing it as block yourself, but these brokers are working with different carriers to create, they're calling them captives, and but they're putting them into a pool of larger groups to help to protect them. But there's some real difficulty if they want to get back out. So there's some of this is, you know, just like real time. I think in Western Massachusetts, we have a couple of years before this would be very common in this size market, but it, you know, you can just, the conversations just in the year that I've been there have increased significantly. Groups that have never asked about self-funding are asking a lot of questions.
So what are they looking, when you go in and you have that conversation with them, what kind of questions are they asking, and what kind of information are you finding you need to take into those conversations?
A lot of it has to do with detailed information about their claims experience so that they can then understand what the stop loss would. I mean, a lot of it is, it's very financially driven. I don't think they've got the sophistication to ask questions about, you know, like what they can do with plan design necessarily. I think they're just assuming that they would take their same plan, at least the conversations I've been involved in. It sounds like they're just looking at, you know, what is going to result in us getting, you know, a lower cost for what we have today. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily thinking about population health or the flexibility components. It's really, this is a price-driven, a cost-driven equation for them at this point.
So how do you get them to take a step back and look holistically at all of the different levers that could be used to help them control?
And a lot of the brokers are also unsophisticated and don't necessarily, they like the fully insured.
Sure,
it's easy. It's simple, it's easy for them, right? So I think that education piece, there's only a few that are really looking at it.
Yeah, so like Tom said, those broker relationships. Yeah, Alex?
Yeah, this is more of a question for maybe Tom, Keith, or I guess anybody in the room. You know, on a reinsurance side, on a fully insured, not stop loss, but fully insuring membership for health plans, our sales cycle is several years. There are a number of people in this room that I'm working on like year 15, still waiting.
Not to say it,
No names. But it's a long, long sales cycle, and I'm sure the Five Life fully insured group, you know, you don't even, there is no sales cycle. It shows up one day. The broker sends it in. You don't even know it existed. Where, what's the expectation of the sales cycle for the 300 life self-funded group? What is it? Is it a 2 year? You know, you see it 1 year. You know, you're not going to get it. You're going to get it that second year. Is it longer than that? Is it significantly different, or is it different at all than the 200 life fully insured group? What should the expectation be on sales cycle?
Brad or Tom or
my experience has been the sales cycles is probably 2 years. You know, the first time to introduce it, especially if they're, you know, if they're fully insured, if they're self-funded, you've got a chance to get them the first year. One of the interesting things I found out, and of course, you know, I always learn things the hard way. I never learn things the easy way. Probably three different times in 1 year, I remember getting the nods from the executive team at that employer to go self-funded. And there was one person in the room that had no way was that person going to make this decision. That was HR. It's too much. So we learned. Too much work for HR. So I would make sure that my eye contact in that room was with the HR person mostly. And it was how I'm going to help her, typically, and our team to transition this so that this is not going to be a daunting task for her. But just things like that. I mean, it affects the sales cycle.
Yeah, Steve Hartnett with Steve. ASR. Oh, this is on. I would add that I think a 300-person group probably has a 3-year sales cycle. It all depends on whether the agent is the controlling agent and is sophisticated, and if you have the economic buyer. So those are the key, and if your representative of your ASO can get in front of the decision maker. If that person can't get in front of the decision maker until year two or year three, you're prolonging the sales cycle. Mm-hmm. The key thing is conveying your story.
Brad, and then Keith.
Yeah, our experience has been much the same as what Tom described. For an ASO prospect in that size group, it's typically a 2 or potentially a 3 year sales cycle. So we're helping our account executives get a little bit more strategic about their sales processes rather than just waiting for that RFP or request for quote to come in. And Tom, I think, hit it on the head with the comment about HR as well, because typically that's the barrier, particularly moving from a fully insured account to a self-funded account, getting the finance folks, the CFO involved, but then helping the HR person understand how you're going to help him or her make this an easier transition has been important. So it's a multi-layered sales process to really kind of carry it through at the end.
Mm-hmm. Keith?
Yeah, I think most my comments will be similar to what was said here. I would just add on, we would try to look at who did the HR person report to? Was it the CFO or was it somebody else? Because then we'd want to work with the CFO and do that kind of negotiating internally to make sure that they were working internally with the HR person. And then we would describe all the services we could bring to the table to help that HR person make that transition. Because, again, they usually have a very small staff in this size of an employer, and so they're taking care of everything, that, you know, not just benefits, and that's all we focus on, but they're focusing on everything else. So they see it simply as a daunting challenge to make this change. And so showing what you can do to help them make that change is a lot better process in moving that sales mm-hmm. cycle up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What is the change in the HR function? What changes for them? What do they have to do differently between self-funded and?
Well, whether it's moving from fully insured to self-funded or self-funded to self-funded, the changes are they've got to work with that new administrator to implement and understand the plan design. That implementation process is a very long and tedious process to get that information out of them, so that when you start paying claims, you don't have all these gotchas when the claims start coming out the door. And so they just don't want to sit down. They don't want to have to worry about how they're going to do open enrollment. And the other thing is they don't want to hear from their employees coming in their door and say, why did you change our insurance again this year?
Mm-hmm.
Or it's not the same network. I don't have the same provider. Why did you do this? So mm-hmm. they're just avoiding any kind of additional interaction, if you would, from a negative perspective.
They don't want to rock the boat or do anything.
Right.
Yeah. Rick?
Yeah, so I'll throw out a hypothesis based on what I'm hearing. Incumbency is a particularly strong advantage in this part of the market, I think, right? I think people would agree with that. And I would argue that it's probably because of the relationship-driven nature. We're dealing here with brokers rather than consultants. So that triangle between the broker, the stop-loss, and the employer is largely relationship driven. And some people have said, well, the broker is not sophisticated. Well, he may be not sophisticated, but really good at holding on to that relationship. And also, I think you'd all agree with me that changing administrators in a self-funded plan is a pain in the ass. It's not something anybody goes into for no good reason. So my question for the group, for anybody, is, what to break the advantage of incumbency, what have you seen in the market? What are the pain points that will get that broker and that employer to really start to consider to move from the relationship that they have in place? What are those key pain points?
Tom?
I think first and foremost, to get them to move is really a story that you're telling as a regional health plan and controlling costs in your community. Second thing I think is BUCA does a horrible job at reporting for the most part. And that's a very generalized comment. But compared to what you can do on a local basis to really engage those employers and their members is a very, very powerful story. And I think that's got to be the focus when you're talking about moving or changing administrators.
Steve?
I was going to answer on a prior question just on the HR component. Not to be over-intimidating to HR, but when we sell a group and replace it uninsured into self-funded, we have a three-hour implementation meeting. And we are going through eligibility and SPD components with a fine-tooth comb. And so when you replace insured to insured, you're templating your insured carrier eligibility and benefits. But when you go self-funded and you have a stop-loss carrier mirroring your coverage and your SPD, you need to make sure that the eligibility is tied correctly. I worked for two different HMOs, and they have great difficulty in customizing their eligibility requirements, let alone the benefits. And that is very intricate to stop-loss coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got to go into the benefits, and I call it more, instead of benefits, it's risk management. And you get into stuff like bariatric surgery, spousal carve-outs, all different kinds of components, auto exclusions. These are risk management components that insured carriers don't typically look at, that an economic buyer is going to say, you're saving me money and shifting risk. And that's part of the three-hour implementation meeting. It's not even part of the sales process on the front end.
Uh-huh.
So that does impact HR.
So I think that there are three things that I'm hearing. One is the relationship building that as part of the sales process. The second one that Ashley mentioned, which is educating and helping them take a look at what are all the different levers that can be used and come into and come in into play. And then lastly, that implementation process, whether it's reporting is certainly a part of it, and that the transition. So excellent discussion. One other point, and then we're going to actually expand on what you've just outlined here in terms of the relationship building, understanding your customers, and building those relationships over the long term. And we'll continue this discussion. So another question, then we'll take a couple of questions, and we'll take a quick break.
Something that impressed me when I came to IU Health Plans as a broker for over 20 years with my own agency is watching the project management that happens on the implementation side. So we literally have an entire project management team, and today they might be, you know, doing implementation, but tomorrow they might be, you
doing
know,
something else.
Doing something. I don't know. I can't think of what it would be, but it sounds very simple, but just a spreadsheet with red, green, and yellow. And, you know, today it's your responsibility, and here's the date, and here's the red. And it's every single week going over that, and then the implementation process, they do the same thing. And I feel like I get a lot of positive feedback about that. Again, it's something that's very simple, but most people are visual people. And if you're looking at an HR person who's freaking out and they can pick up something that's three pages long in a spreadsheet and see red, green, and yellow with whose responsibility is, seemed to me to be a really neat process. So I don't know if anybody else does that, but this whole project management thing was, I thought, was a big coup for us.
Dane?
Yeah, just to piggyback off of that, so we use a Gantt chart, which is really helpful in a timeline as to when everything is going to happen. So we go back from the effective date and just work our way back. That makes the client feel really comfortable about, you know, we have enough time to get all this done. And so they know, and we're committed to making those certain things happen at certain times. So that works, I think, really well to help get them comfortable with the transition. So,
yeah, these last two comments from IU and Health Alliance Plan underscore what Rick said is this is nobody wants to do this. It's not easy. So how do you make it as easy as possible?
Kevin?
Yeah,
I just want to ask a question. When we talked about timelines before, and it feeds into what Rick said before, I didn't hear anyone say renewals. Because my experience, we see it from a 50,000-foot level. And what's happening is that in May, groups of 500, 1,000, they're done. Right? You know, I could almost go plan by plan and just tell you it's finished. The renewal is done, if they're going to change, et cetera. In the smaller group market, you know, it's September. It's done. They get a 90-day notice, and it's over. But no one said renewals. If you go out with a 25% renewal right now, they're going to shop. Maybe they'll go from insured to insured or insured to self-funded, but they're not going to stay with a 25% hit. Mm-hmm. So isn't that really the driver? I think so.
What do you think of that?
Yeah, renewals are absolutely a driver, but what happens in our market is that the fully insured renewals aren't out until like 30 days prior to the effective date. And our implementation time frame is a lot longer than that. So that lots of times we have to just step back. We're in the process right now of trying to compress our implementation time frames for these smaller groups because we're missing the boat. So instead of looking to us to self-fund some of these groups, they'll just find another quick fully insured, someone willing to buy the business. So, mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. Renewals are what drive people to look at primarily self-funding as well. How can they save some money because they can no longer afford the cost of these increases?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Excuse me. Yeah, I would only say when looking at the renewal is what's the claim to premium ratio and what's the prognosis of the claimants. Most folks in the room here probably do retrospective underwriting. When we're a TPA and we're playing offense, we're attacking your retrospective underwriting. because we're doing prospective underwriting. And if we know that you had a Hep C at $90,000 on your specialty meds that's done, you might be retrospectively building that into your forward rate. We're cutting it clean, and we just beat your rate, even with a 12-12 contract medical and Rx. So when looking at a 25% increase, we look at how much you're hitting the group on trend, how much you're hitting the group on credibility, how much you're retrospectively underwriting, and we're conveying to the client that you are getting a punitive renewal based on all these loads, and you can avoid all that by having a more credible renewal based on your new and healthy prospective outlook on your utilization. So that's how the offense and defense is played differently on a renewal versus a new business account.
And just a quick comment about Steve's comments. When you have both the fully insured program and a self-insured program that you're quoting, that becomes an interesting conversation with your underwriters, because it's strategically as a plan, where would you prefer that risk to be? And so for us, we can go both ways, but internally, hopefully by the time it gets to the client, you've cleaned this up, but internally, end up with some interesting contradictions. That's something to be aware of as you're looking at that, if you have both of those products in your portfolio.